Welcome to Dear Jane. I am Scott Baker, and she is Marcy Little. Marcy, how are you?
Doing great. Excited about today's conversation.
Yep. Here at the front end, I think, is where we're supposed to, again, tell people, hit subscribe. You're supposed to smash the subscribe button, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to tell your friends. You're supposed to follow us on social media. All the things, right?
All the things. Follow, what subscribe, else never miss an episode. We have really phenomenal guests on the show. I just want a special shout out to our producer, Kate. She does a phenomenal job lining up these guests for you guys, and I have so much fun talking with them. So I hope that you will subscribe so you don't miss out.
Yep, absolutely. So, and you can follow us on all the socials. Just look up Dear Jane Podcast. So yeah, we're going to have a great conversation today talking about the mental health ramifications of abortion. We're going to talk to an expert who is a clinician who deals with that on a regular basis, and it sort of shine the light of truth that might sort of contradict what some of the other more louder voices say out there. So we're going to get into that in just a second. But in the meantime, quick note to our sponsor, Choose Life Marketing. Tell us about them.
Yes. If you work for a pro-life organization, you need to talk to our friends at Choose Life Marketing. They can help get your message out there to the right people, whether you are trying to reach abortion-minded women, whether you are trying to educate, whether you are trying to change hearts and minds, whether, honestly, you need to raise money to be able to do any of that or to do any of your life-saving work. Choose Life Marketing can help. They have a phenomenal team of all 100% pro-life team members. This is the issue. This is what they care about. They want to help turn the tide for life in our country and also around the world. They're international. So wherever you are, if you're part of a pro-life group, reach out to Choose Life Marketing. They can really help with your marketing efforts and your fundraising efforts.
ChooseLifeMarketing.com. There we go. Do that in there.
Thank you.
So our guest today is Robin Atkins. She does a lot of different things. She works with the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs. She is a mental health expert. She has her own clinic in Indiana. And so she has some real world plus some clinical experience of the mental health ramifications of abortions. And we're going to talk to her today about some of those and really what are the impacts of abortion in the short term and the long term for women and men. So we'll talk to Robin today here on Dear Jane.
Robin, thank you so much for joining us today on Dear Jane.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's just jump right in. I know that the pro-life movement often makes claims that there are negative psychological effects of abortion. Is that true? Are there studies that support that?
There are studies that support increased risks when you compare abortions to live births. We can't claim that they're causal, so there are no studies indicating that abortion causes psychological risks, but there are lots and lots of research studies that show a correlation between a woman who's had an abortion compared to a woman who's had a live birth and the psychological impacts of that.
What are some of the different emotions and psychological impacts that you have seen?
So the one that I see most often studied is the increased risk of suicidal ideation. So in the majority of the research that I've seen, especially in the last 10 years that's come out, shows at minimum a 50% increased risk of suicidal ideation in women after abortion when compared to women after a live birth. And so what we've learned from those studies are a couple of things. Number one, there appears to be some type of protective factor against psychological harms in a live birth. The reason why I say that is because these studies show that there's psychological risks after a miscarriage and a stillbirth as well. So it's not just an abortion, but any type of pregnancy loss increased risks of suicidal ideation. Some studies have abortion being the highest risk and others have miscarriage being the highest risk. But any type of pregnancy loss increases the risk compared to live birth. So we know there's some type of protective factor in live birth against psychological complications. Another thing it tells us is when we take out the women who have had pre-existing mental health complications prior to pregnancy, we kind of see the same protective factor of live birth, but we see an increased risk of mental health complications postpartum postpartum if there was an abortion and pre-existing mental health complications prior to the abortion. In addition, we see that women who have mental health complications tend to be more likely to choose abortion than women that do not.
Is this something that the mental health practitioner community, I guess, has been equipped to kind of probe into? Like, do they know to ask questions about abortions in the patient's history? Kind of talk to us about that side of things.
That's a really good question. And so I want to give your audience a kind of a framework of my perspective of that, because it depends on which practitioner you ask on what perspective they're going to give. So I've been a provider for almost 20 years, which means I completed my education well over 10 years ago. And so what is being taught now is different than what was being taught 10 years ago. When I was going through school, I do not remember abortion being mentioned at all. Not once in my undergrad or graduate school. So I would say there's no equipping of dealing with that. But there also wasn't a lot of specialization in general. There weren't specialties. Everybody was a general mental health practitioner. So I don't know that I would expect that to be specific. There wasn't really specific about any given situation other than maybe addiction. But that was still new when I was going through school to be able to specialize in addictions. In the last 10 years, we've seen a lot more come through, especially higher education, like master's programs and doctorate programs, specific perspectives of any hot button issue you can think of that's going on in culture now, including abortion. So even in the organizations that claim to speak for providers, like the American Psychological Association, the American Counseling Association, they really, since 1960, have been promoting a particular framework around the abortion topic, that abortion has no negative impacts on mental health. That's been the line from those organizations since about 1960. If you dig into it, 1960s, when they started joining forces with Planned Parenthood and became lobbyists rather than professional organizations. So that kind of all makes sense on how that unfolded, and I'm not going to drag everybody through the whole history of that. But that has changed the education coming through. And so I'm not going to say your average practitioner has in any way, shape, or form automatically decided how they feel about a patient who might come to them and reveal hardship. I trust that many practitioners can set aside whatever their personal beliefs are on any given situation and be patient focused first. But I would say the schooling is very much from the perspective of there are no harms to abortion at all.
You said that you have faith that the practitioner can put their own personal feelings aside. I hope that's the case. Why can't the groups that represent them seem to do that?
That's a really good question. I would encourage anyone to follow the money around why they don't do that. There's a lot of money in lobbying, and there's a lot of circular money. So the people that donate to an organization, that organization does some lobbying, so donates to the legislator, whoever that might be on a state or federal level, and that legislator then trickles funds back to the organization that's donating to the professional organization. So just as an example, I'm not saying this is happening, but an example of that might be if Planned Parenthood made some type of donation to the American Counseling Association, and the American Counseling Association lobbies for abortion access, and then the government gives some type of grant to Planned Parenthood, you can see how the money just cycles around and around and around. And the average practitioner is not making money out of any of that, so they aren't as incentivized to do that type of thing.
As a licensed counselor, you understand the impact of abortion on mental health. Can you tell us more about your firsthand experience doing this work?
So my firsthand experience as a counselor or as a woman who's had an abortion, which one do you prefer?
I think both. Yeah.
Okay. Let's start with my personal experience first, and then as a provider, it's easier for me to think of it that way. So my personal experience was in my early 20s in the year 2000. And it was not the typical experience in the fact that when I presented to Planned Parenthood, I had no idea I was pregnant and was not seeking an abortion. I was approaching Planned Parenthood for STD testing. While I was there, they did do a really good job with the STD testing. I did test positive. They treated it. They handled that very well. And so I'll give them credit for that. But while I was having that testing done, they ran blood work to test for the STD that I thought I might have. I did not realize they ran pregnancy testing as well. They did not tell me I was pregnant. What they did say was it would be a real shame to have a child with someone who would give you an STD, because once I was diagnosed as having it, it was clear that my partner was cheating on me. And so they leaned heavily into the, you don't want to be trapped in that kind of relationship. And so we're going to help you prevent pregnancy is how they framed it to me. At that time, I was very young. I had no idea how a cycle worked or what RU486 was or the abortion pill was. So I had no idea even what they were really giving me. They gave me a pill to take there at the clinic, which I did. And then they sent me home with a brown bag with another pill inside, which I took the next day. And so there was no informed consent. I had no idea of what the process would be like. It was kind of explained as it would be like a period. It was nothing like a period. It was worse than the miscarriage that I experienced years later, physically and emotionally. So it took about 19 years for me to really unpack that event. I kind of, in my heart, after it happened, knew something was wrong, but I didn't pursue it. I just kind of shoved it down. And then when I started doing work at a local church close to me, I started talking about women who have experience with Plan B. And so the way Plan B works is it's designed to prevent implantation, but it doesn't necessarily prevent fertilization. And so there are women who have come to me concerned, like I may have ended up miscarrying a fertilized egg or a zygote or embryo. And so I started talking about that. And that's kind of when I started thinking about my experience and like, I wonder if it was something closer to that that I had experienced. And it wasn't until I started talking with a few individuals who actually study the physical side effects of abortion pill versus Plan B versus miscarriage that it really became clear what had happened to me. And then when I started learning about cycles, I was able to put that together as well as where I would have been at my cycle and how it was clear I was pregnant. So it was a very coercive experience, clearly illegal, but by the time I had figured that out, it was years after any kind of statute of limitations of when I could. I did attempt to get my medical records. It's been far too long. They've been shredded and destroyed, and I would expect that. I, as a provider, don't keep records past 7 years, so I am not trying to claim they did that in any devious attempt to cover what happened, but I can't pursue them at this point. So I went through my own retreat to receive healing for that. It was a Deeper Still retreat. If people aren't familiar with that organization, I highly recommend they check them out. My whole heart is with Deeper Still. They're wonderful. And there are other wonderful organizations as well. Rachel's Vineyard is another one, and the Institute of Reproductive Grief Care. I do a lot of collaborative work with them, and they have wonderful programming as well, as does Support After Abortion. And Support After Abortion has support for men and women, which is extremely important. So I went through my own retreat, my own counseling, to make sure that my experience didn't negatively impact my patients' experiences. Prior to doing that and prior to really acknowledging what had happened to me was an abortion, I had seen women come in talking to me about their abortion experiences. I didn't have really a political opinion, and so I wasn't really concerned with promoting any type of you should or shouldn't feel this way about it. And so I just followed the women's experience, and not once did it feel empowering to them. It always felt some type of loss or grief attached to it, whether or not they regretted it. Does that make sense?
Not probably does to Marcy, but you have to go slower. You have to spell it out for me. So say that again.
Sure. So regardless of where any particular patient's political perspective might be, I've never had a patient that didn't feel some type of grief or loss related to their abortion experience, even if they didn't regret getting the abortion. And so I can break that down a little bit more, giving you my experience.
Yeah. Because I'm thinking of the whole shout your abortion people, right? Mm-hmm. Or I've never regretted it, that sort of thing. So that's what I'm trying to jibe the two of what you're saying here. So yeah, that's very interesting.
Sure. Those are two different demographics too. I would say that the people that are doing the shout your abortion or I've never regret it or are online very hostile about it probably aren't seeking therapy about it either. So that it probably wouldn't see them in my office. But in my own experience, for example, while I deeply grieve and regret that experience, I am grateful that I'm not tied to the man who I got pregnant with. He was very abusive. And so I do regret my experience, but I can understand women who grieve a loss, but are also grateful in some ways that they don't have whatever the negative outcomes would have been in relationship to that pregnancy. So it's a very complicated thing. And that's part of the problem with the studies about regret overall. For example, like the Turnaway study, there's a lot of problems with the Turnaway study, but one of the biggest problems is when you study for regret, it's way too complicated of an experience and emotions change so much over time that a single snippet of 300 women at a single point in time, and I know they studied it over 5 years, but even so, my own experience, I didn't have a full understanding for 19 years of how I felt about it. So I don't think that those studies do a very accurate job of the complexity of the emotions women walk through.
Do you think there are other things that could be studied? So I know the Turnaway study looked at regret. Are there other emotions or other outcomes that could be studied that would give us a more accurate picture of what women experience after abortion?
I love that question. I'm going to answer it in kind of a roundabout way. What I would like to see done is actual informed consent. If abortion is going to remain legal, I would like actual informed consent done. And I'll explain what I mean by that. And we could do a study based on that. So if we actually had women receiving informed consent and then followed them through 20 years of their life and discussed every so often with them their feelings around it in an open questioned kind of interview fashion, we would probably get much closer to what is actually happening with women. Actual informed consent would mean women being told what is happening to their body and to the body of their offspring. I'm fine with when informed consent is being given, whoever's doing the informed consent following the language of the woman in front of them. If that woman uses the word fetus, I am fine with that. If she uses the word baby, I'm fine with that. But they need to be told what's happening to their offspring. They also need to be told of the potential physical and mental health risks of abortion, and they need to be told there are alternatives as well. And this is where I see a lot of lacking informed consent. A majority of women seek abortion, not necessarily because they just don't want to have a child or do not want to be pregnant. It's because there's crisis situations going on around the pregnancy. They're in an unsafe relationship, or they're financially struggling, or they're a single parent and aren't sure if they can bring another child into the household and how are they going to care for that child along with their other children. So there's often extenuating circumstances surrounding the pregnancy. And if we can provide them with alternative options, I think more women than not would choose the alternative options other than abortion. So if they were being offered, we can get you connected with this service or that service, which is what pregnancy resource centers do, but abortion clinics do not do that.
Yeah, so actually they present more of a choice than what these abortion clinics might do. You mentioned in passing earlier, and I'm glad you did, that it's not just the women who need help individually, but there's couples who experience this together, and then just men who might have this in their past. I mean, it's across the board, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's interesting, when I talk to the men who have experienced this, they are so afraid to speak typically because of one of two reasons. Either one, they didn't speak up because they felt like they were supporting the woman's choice, and they regret not speaking up, both for themselves, but also because later that their partner regretted it as well. And they felt like they didn't do a good job of protecting her, whether or not they're together. Or they actually were part of the coercion to convince a woman to pursue an abortion, and they regret that later, both being a part of it, coercing her, but also their own loss as well. And there's so much shame tied to all of that for men, on top of a culture that already tells men you don't get a say in abortion at all. It's really hard for them to be able to speak openly about their experiences. And I understand women who have been harmed because they were coerced into an abortion by a partner, not wanting to hear from men who regret that. That is a difficult thing for them to hear. But I also understand men need healing too, and men need opportunity to hold themselves accountable and take accountability for their actions as well. And so I think that's a population that's much underserved.
Do you notice a difference in the women you see who have gone the surgical abortion route versus the self-medicated abortion pill, take it at home, have the abortion at home, that route in between those two?
I see a lot of differences between the two, and it's not as clear cut as I think is presented in when I see it portrayed in media. I see kind of left-wing media, for lack of a better term, portraying it as either way is fine, no big deal, no consequences. And I kind of see right-wing media portray it, for the lack of a better term, as chemical or medical abortions are much harder for the woman than surgical abortions. I see the women telling me they're hard, but in different ways. So in a surgical abortion, women will tell me it's very difficult because they didn't experience the process awake. And so it feels like one moment they were in crisis and pregnant, the next moment they wake up and they feel empty, both physically and emotionally, but they don't have any memory of the event. It's similar to, and the way it's felt. I don't want anyone to confuse me connecting these two events as being related in any other way than women who have gone under general anesthesia and had a C-section will tell me they also feel like they didn't experience birth. And there's confusion and kind of this cognitive dissonance around what has happened, and trying to reconcile that is very difficult. For women who have had chemical abortions or medical abortions, part of the problem is there's no real information given on what that's going to look like or feel like at home. And for many women like myself, it physically feels like you are dying, both just from the amount of blood loss, but also from the pain. And so there's a lot of fear that's happening while the process is happening. And because no one's telling you what to expect, it feels like it must be going wrong. And then there's a lot of fear to reach out for help or to go somewhere for help. And in my case, I don't know whether I needed medical help or not. I'm alive and I'm grateful for that. But I sure felt like I was dying during the process. And then I did not, but some women see their baby after that. And so that in itself is a traumatic experience for many women, whereas in a surgical abortion, you do not. I will say that the abortion imagery that we see sometimes will trigger some of my patients with surgical abortions to then have to process that part of it. They did not see that during or after their abortion, but if they see it years later, it's very difficult for them.
So I'm curious about your story. You talked about Deeper Still and the impact that it had for you. What is it that finally is like, this is the thing that sort of finally resonated with me and helped the most?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am a Christian. And so for me, going to a retreat where I could be surrounded by other Christian women and men, that was a huge part of it to me too, having men there with us. For us to process together, even though none of those men were related to my abortion or my life now, having them there to acknowledge their experience was extremely healing. And the freedom in that my worth isn't in my actions, but is in Christ, was so healing for me that he could forgive me for what I had done. He can, on behalf of my child, forgive me for what I've done. And so that was a hugely impactful experience for me. There were two other experiences that were pretty impactful too. And I don't know that everybody can have one of these experiences, but because of some of the volunteer work I do, I had an opportunity to meet with a doctor who formerly performed abortions at a dinner And I apologize to that doctor on behalf of women for putting that doctor in a position of doing abortions, women seeking that from them, and there being a demand or a drive for it. And that doctor in turn apologized for being a person that offered that. And that was a hugely healing experience for both of us, taking accountability for our sides of it. And then me talking about the abortion with my parents, my siblings, my husband, who was not the father of the child I aborted, but has, I might get a little emotional about this, been very beautiful about, even though he wasn't the biological father, taking ownership of that's your child. So when we talk about him being missing, it's my child too. So I don't have to differentiate when I'm talking about my abortion and my child that I lost. I don't have to play that game of all of that when we're doing that amongst family. So that was just a very beautiful gesture on his part of your pain is my pain, of your loss is my loss. And that was very healing. And then my children, I have four. Two of them are teenagers, two of them are younger, and they all know about their two siblings that are not with us. The two older ones know about the abortion itself and their response. I was prepared for any response. I was prepared for them being angry, upset, hurt, and they were all of those things, but majority was very concerned about, was I okay? Was I going to be okay? And I'm very concerned that I grew up in a society that would allow that and them not wanting that for themselves or their friends. And so their response was very graceful. And even now, they were told like 3 years ago. And since then, my son, who's now 14, he wrote a book on abortion when he was 12 and got it published. And it's basically about my pregnancy with him was very high risk and I was encouraged to abort and did not. So he wrote his experience about being a child with disabilities and how grateful he is to be alive. And despite there is ongoing medical issues from that pregnancy for him and I, we're both grateful that that pregnancy continued, even though some of the outcomes were harder. It's a beautiful book. He's such a great kid. And he just went to a camp called Life Defenders, trying to learn more about the arguments about abortion and like how to, he wants to be an attorney, so how to debate well and things. And so he came back from the camp with all this new information and knowledge about the specifics around abortion that I have never shared with him. And he came back asking me questions like, so Mom, you said you had a chemical abortion, right? Not a surgical one. Yes. Well, I've heard that that is way harder for women because, well, and like just asking and wanting to know my, so they're just, their responses have been so healing. And so I don't know that everybody has that experience of such a supportive family, but that has been very healing for me. And many, many, many people in the pro-life community have been so very supportive of me, and that's helped my journey as well. Some not, some have not, but many have been. And I have some friends on the pro-choice side that have been very supportive well of, we encourage you to speak openly about your experience. We don't want that hidden from women either. And that has been healing as well.
That's really beautiful to see just the redemption from that in your own family. I'm curious about what is a typical, if there is a typical, relational consequence of abortion. So let's say a woman goes and gets an abortion. Maybe her boyfriend or husband said, you know, this is not the right time. We should, you know, we need to be in a better place. Does the abortion often help those relationship challenges, or does it make it worse?
So that's a good question. Abortion often doesn't help anything. It doesn't help women get out of poverty. It doesn't help women get an education. It doesn't help women be in a safer relationship. And it doesn't help save relationships that are not in a stable place. Typically, those relationships end at some point. That is also true after pregnancy loss. The majority of relationships that go through stillbirths or abortions end in separation or divorce. But the one thing that I'm very, very clear on from the research is abortion doesn't solve any of the problems that it is offered for. So that is a whole cultural issue that needs to be addressed on a different level. Abortion is like a band-aid for a gunshot wound. It's just not solving the actual problem. It's just creating kind of a new festering wound that we're just trying to hide.
Wow. Yeah, that's such a good point, that it's praised as or put out there as a solution to all of these issues and challenges that women face that are real, but it doesn't actually address any of those.
We are so grateful for the work that Robin Atkins does with women and men who are seeking healing from their abortion journeys. If you would like to read more of what she has written and follow her on social media, she is on Twitter @TruthAgape. And then you can also subscribe to her Substack. There she is @RobinAtkins. You can find where she'll be doing a lot of her writing, and she just is a wealth of information on this topic, so we hope you will check her out. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode.